All right, I'm going to. Is on? On. I'm going to call the meeting to order, the regular meeting of the Board of Directors on May 28th, and I'm going to ask for the roll to be called.
Director Shore?
Here.
Director Borja?
Here.
Director Perez Gil?
Here.
Director Rodri?
Here.
Director Matthews?
Here.
Vice President Navarro?
Here.
President Mendel?
Here. I don't see a flag.
There's one tucked behind the screen. Yep.
Oh, yeah.
So we'll have the presentation of the colors by Andrea Haynes.
Good job. Good eye, Linda.
Gladly. As soon as we get a flag out. Number one, veteran.
And I'll ask Dr. Director Rogers, Director
Matthews,
to lead us in the pledge.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Do I hear a motion to approve the agenda?
I move.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Very good. This is now the time for public comments from the audience. They may be made on items not listed on the agenda that are of public interest and within the subject matter jurisdiction of the district. The board has a policy of limiting speakers to no more than 3 minutes. We can't take action on any of those items that aren't listed on the agenda. Public input may be offered on agenda items when they come up for discussion and or action. And I would remind people that there's also an agenda that starts at, there's also a foundation meeting too. Is there any public comment? Hearing none, we'll move to the consent agenda. Consent agenda includes the board minutes from a special meeting on April 23rd, the board meeting, regular board meeting on April 23rd, a special meeting on May 14th, the finance committee's financial statements from April, and do I hear a motion to accept the consent agenda?
So moved. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Now we are moving to the program committee. And I will turn the floor over to Director Rogers.
Did you find the wrong one?
Yeah.
Well, this is.
That's the foundation.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't know it was on both pages. That was a page. Sorry.
Okay.
Public hearing. We're now going to talk about the expansion and rezoning background and where we are on the maps. And I'll call on Justin Levitt to bring us forward here.
Thank you, President Senzel, members of the board, members of the public who are here tonight. It's a pleasure to be with you to talk about this issue. So just to kind of briefly touch on what we're doing here tonight for those of you who are coming to this for the first time. As a result of the board's expansion last November, two additional board members were appointed from the new addition areas. However, state law requires that districts be, or zones in this case, be equal in population, and it created a launch of a process to redistrict or rezone the district to create 7 new equally populated districts from the new expanded region. This does not change, for example, the board's continued responsibility to all members of the expanded district, but this will create new voting districts that we will use for the first time in the November 2020 election. One thing that I will note is that these lines will be used exactly once, because in 2020, we will, of course, be taking the 2020 census, and we're going to get new population figures in 2021 that will require a rezoning prior to the 2022 election. However, this process is important because as a result of the expansion, this is really the first time we're looking at the entirety of the new district in the zoning process. And so what we're looking at doing here is this is a second of two of four scheduled public hearings. The first one held last month out in Indio, next week at their Dissonant Cathedral City. We'll then be taking sort of a summer recess and coming back to this in September and October with additional hearings in the Mid-Valley area, with locations to be announced as we confirm those dates and times. Most likely those will also be at 5:30, but we'll confirm the locations. Please continue to check our website as we continue to update this process. So what we're looking at doing here tonight, as we mentioned, this is the second of four scheduled hearings. We have three maps to look at, and I'm going to briefly talk about the factors that went into them, what each map does, and give you an update of what's happened since the April public hearing. To start off, looking at the criteria, the factors that go into drawing these maps, what we have here are two sets of criteria. The first on the left is federal laws. These are our must-dos. These are things the Supreme Court requires of any district lines that are drawn anywhere in the country. And this first one is equal population. Districts have to have more or less the same number of total residents. This uses that census population count. Even though we know the 2010 census is wildly inaccurate, especially in a place where there's a lot of people who come part of the year, the state of California and the Supreme Court require that we use the census to get that total population number. In addition, we have to look at the Federal Voting Rights Act. While we have to look at, or while race cannot be the predominant factor, or even the, the only factor we consider, looking at protected class groups, groups that have historically faced discrimination or barriers to registration, voting, obtaining materials in their language, have to be considered as part of the overall process. In particular, we're going to look at the Latino community throughout the valley, throughout this process. Now, on the right-hand column, we have our traditional criteria. These are the factors that have to be balanced with each other. So, for example, we have to look at communities of interest. Communities of interest are areas that share common problems, common interests, common concerns. Maybe it's history, maybe it's demographics. There's a lot of different ways of defining communities of interest. There might be some that are very specific to a healthcare district as opposed to a school district or to a city. Maybe it has to do with proximity to a hospital, which I know came up in the last public hearing. In addition, we look at boundaries. We talk about major roads. We talk about city and other political boundaries throughout the district. We also talk about natural boundaries, where washes serve to divide communities that don't really connect across those natural features. Or does that freeway or does that road actually serve to bring a community together? That's the kind of conversation we need to have about these boundaries. Of course, as I mentioned, we are looking at redoing this in a couple of years. So looking at what's changed since 2010, what's planned to change, what do we expect to see in the 2020 census numbers, can also enter the process. We have in our demographics, the census's estimate of what the populations are right now. That's not a precise number. It's not going to be the same precise data we get from the 2020 census, but it gives us an idea of which areas have grown more than others. Finally, respecting the voters' wishes, is the principle that voters of the district, particularly those who had an election in 2018, did vote for members of the board, and that this expansion process or this boundary process needs to consider that, and how it considers it can be part of this process as well. Just one bit about the numbering here. State law actually requires for healthcare districts, and only for healthcare districts, that odd and even numbered districts be on different cycles. So a lot of what we're looking at the numbering here, the odd number districts have to be up in 2020. The even number districts will be up in 2022. And sometimes if we see that that area has a different number and a different map, I'll take a look and see which area, if there's a current board member that's been elected from that area or appointed from that area, because that often determines which number that is. That doesn't really affect anything except the year of election. So in addition to the maps here today, we have printouts of the maps in the back. We have over on the table physical copies to take with you. In addition, we have an online viewer that really lets you search for addresses, zoom in. It's sort of like a Google Maps sort of algorithm where you can search and turn on and off the different maps. We have the cities on there. We have the current districts on there. We invite you to look at that interactive viewer to really get a sense of the different maps, especially at that small street level detail that it may be hard to see even with a blown up map. At the first meeting in April, we came with two different maps, the Agave and the Yucca map. And so we continue to have them tonight, unchanged from what we presented to you last time. These kind of were two initial concepts to start the conversation flowing. One thing that I will note, especially as you look at the paper copies of the map, is that on the first page, the dotted black line represents the current five zones within the district. And you can see that the expansion of the district literally meant tripling the geographic size of the district, and more than doubled the population of the district as well. Some of the features of the Agave map, one of the things we looked at doing was creating three majority Latino areas, areas 4, 6, and 7. Area 4 in the Cathedral City area also includes Thousand Palms and parts of Desert Hot Springs and the unincorporated community of Garnet. Areas 6 and 7 between them divide the cities of Indio, Coachella, and all the way down to the Salton Sea, basically putting two representatives down to include the Salton Sea area. In terms of the other seats, Zone 1 is currently based in the Palm Springs area, continues to be a Palm Springs-based area, although it has portions of Rancho Mirage and a part of Cathedral City between Highway 111 and Fred Waring Drive. Zone 2 continues to include most of the northern communities, the Northern Strip, Desert Hot Springs, Desert Edge. This expansion allows us to come into Palm Desert a bit more, and it actually has a lot of people within the Palms, within the desert or Palm Desert community. Area 3 continues to be a very southern district, mostly south of 111. It adds portions of Indian Wells, La Quinta, and Palm Desert along the southern strip of the healthcare district. Zone 5 basically in this map includes Bermuda Dunes, portions of La Quinta and Palm Desert, and the western portion of Indio, basically using Monroe Street here as the dividing line between areas 5 and 6, for zones 5 and 6. The Yucca map was a map that tried to look at what would it be if we could get three majority Latino districts into the East Valley area. And so one of the things we look at here is that areas 4, or 5, 6, and 7 are three majority Latino areas in the East Valley. All of them include portions of Indio and Coachella, and they divide other adjacent communities in order to make that happen or make that three majority districts. However, one thing we can look at if we compare the maps is that even though we've got three majority Latino districts, in terms of registration and voting, the Latino percentages in two of those districts, 5 and 6, are rather low compared to the Agave map. So one of the big trade-offs here is that as we, in many of these cases, as we lower the Latino population of a district, those voting and registration figures diminish a lot faster than that Latino population total. And that's because of different registration rates, different age structures. Latino community tends to be younger, less likely to have citizenship, less likely to be registered, particularly in that rural area that includes Thermal, Necco, Oasis, down to the Salton Sea itself. In the Yucca map, I wanted to create a map that really looked at trying to keep District 4 as much in Cathedral City as possible. And so to that extent, it includes Cathedral City and portions of Palm Springs that basically correspond to Palm Springs City Council District 1, DeMuth Park, Gidget Mountain Gateway, those neighborhoods. This one keeps District or Zone 2 much more of a northern district, so all of Desert Hot Springs, all of Garnet, everything north as much as possible of the freeway, coming down to get a portion of Desert or Palm Desert, but not as much as in the first map, in the Agave map. This map divides cities like La Quinta, Bermuda Dunes, in order to create those three majority Latino districts. After we showed these maps at the last public hearing, we heard the board request a third map. And this, and the Mesquite map came out of that process of trying to implement a number of the board's recommendations made at the last public hearing. And so if we look at the Mesquite map, one of the things it really attempts to minimize is the number of cities that are divided. And so, for example, we've really divided we've really minimized the number of divisions as much as possible throughout the entire district. So, for example, all of La Quinta in this map is in Zone 5. All of Indian Wells is in Zone 3. Sometimes it was not possible to keep cities entirely together. And one of the really issues that we run into is that the population numbers don't always work exactly as we want. Indio, for example, is too large to be kept entirely in one zone. It has a population of around 80,000. Each zone has a population closer to 60,000. And in other cases, Palm Springs has a population of 45,000. It is bordered by the district boundary on three sides. And so it has to get population from somewhere else to make up the numbers. And so these are kind of the moving pieces, the jigsaw puzzle that we're trying to put together. How do we balance the populations? We have to by law with the other criteria as we try to put this together. A couple of things I want to note about the Mesquite map. Because it's the new map, I want to talk about it in a little more detail. This map only has two majority Latino seats. Zone 6 in Indio, which is entirely in the city of Indio, and Zone 7, Zone 6 has a portion of Coachella, I should mention that. In part because Zone 7, which includes from Coachella all the way down to the Salton Sea, has too many people to be kept together. Coachella ends up divided almost no matter how you draw the line, because there's too many people in Oasis, Thermal, Mecca, and that area to keep Coachella together and not divide those communities down to the southeast of the district. In this map, like I said, there are 6 and 7 are the two majority Latino seats. Zones 2 and 4 each have a substantial Latino population. Neither of them are majority Latino. Zone 2 is the Desert Hot Springs. It includes, in this map, Desert Hot Springs, Garnet, Desert Edge, Sky Valley, including a portion of North India, kind of entirely north by 10. That was sort of my goal in this map. And Zone 4, Cathedral City, it includes all the neighborhoods in Cathedral City that are more than 20% Latino. It also includes Thousand Palms. It also includes a large portion of Palm Desert. And so with that all together, it pushes that Latino population just below a majority. So not quite a majority district. And so these are some questions that I know I've had some conversations about. I know I've had some conversations with some individual board members over the last couple of weeks about the different maps. And I hope we have some of those conversations here tonight so we can get direction on improving these maps and coming toward more of a consensus or a final product that the whole valley can support. So I'm happy to answer any questions and thank you for your time tonight.
I think what we'll do now is open it up to public comment, and I'm going to ask Mr. Espinoza to be the microphone. And if anybody has a public comment, please stand up in front here and you'll get a microphone.
Thank you. Evans. I'll comment from the City of Lachine's perspective as mayor. I prefer the Mesquite map, just keeping our city together. We, knock on wood, are not districts yet. That could change down the road, but we've worked very hard to ensure that all of our north, south, Cove, PGA West areas are still one community. So I like the fact that it keeps the entire 40,000 population of La Quinta as one in Mesquite. So thank you for map number three.
Any other comments?
Good afternoon, board, staff. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yep. My name is Dieter Crawford. I live in the Desert Island Gateway Estates neighborhood. I'm currently the vice president of the Desert Island Gateway Estates Community Action Association, and I'm also on the board for the Desert Island Gateway Health and Wellness Committee. My background is in community health and public health. For the last few years, I've been working in partnership with Desert Healthcare District, Loma Linda University, UCR Health, to implement regional health plans and strategies in the area. And I also helped to work on the last map that got Director Perez Gill elected. The Desert Island Gateway Estates essentially endorsed, I believe it was the orange map that got Perez Gill elected. So I would just like to say, in Desert Island, we support the Yucca map. And the reason being that we support the Yucca map is that the Desert Island Gateway Estates neighborhood is predominantly African American and Hispanic. Most of the community members are low income. It's approximately 480 households. And I just like that it includes the Hispanic population in with the majority minority district that includes much of Cathedral City. And also the Yucca map would include a lot of the Hispanic population that's in Palm Springs, in the San Rafael and Sunrise area of the city. And that's an area that's largely underserved and underrepresented. So I would like to just make sure that we get the Hispanic population over there included in a district where they will have some representation. And then also District 1, it doesn't follow the Palm Springs city limits. I know that it's going to be hard to include the one city in the complete district, but I believe that members in Palm Springs and some of those pockets have more in common with other residents of Palm Springs than they do with Rancho Mirage and some of the other areas of Palm Desert that's being lumped in with District 1. And lastly, but not least, the Hispanic population that's here in Cathedral City Cove. In none of the maps have we included them with the majority Hispanic district. This is a population that has been historically disenfranchised. As you look when you drive around, this whole neighborhood was once predominantly Hispanic, and it has now been leveled. It was caught up in the redevelopment debacle. I'm not even sure where all those Hispanic residents live now. So I'd just like to make sure that we include the few Hispanic residents that are left up here in the number streets to get some representation.
Thank you. Other public comments? All right, let's move to, first of all, do any of the directors have any questions before I ask you for your comments? Okay, do you have any comments?
Thank you. Thank you for all the hard work. I know it's a puzzle putting together and making sure that all the communities stay the same. And, you know, being in zone 2, north of Highway 10, I just know that the communities there are the ones that feel more community-like. You know, when we have a Desert Hot Springs community event, we pull people from Sky Valley and Desert Edge as part of our community. So I would like to see that community stay cohesive.
Other comments?
Okay, well, I did have an opportunity to talk to you the last couple of weeks, and I really appreciate the fact that you have put a lot of effort to incorporate some of the comments that some of the board members, I think Karen and I had at the last meeting. I didn't like it as much when it finally came out, but I'm glad that we had an opportunity to look at it. The one that I'm commenting on is the mesquite, and the reason why I didn't like the outcome is because of the fact that I didn't like the fact that we no longer have two district board members representing the communities in the Eastern Coachella Valley, and I like that. When I saw the pros and cons, I think there's a greater benefit to have two board members serving that area, because it is such a vast area, and to have different opinions to come to two different board members would be good. I do like the Yucca map a little bit more than I liked it the first time I saw it. And the reason I like it is because of the data that you presented. I think that the data speaks very strong in the fact that we do have two districts or two zones that are predominantly Latino represented voters, and that is Zone 6 and Zone 7. So I like those two. I'm not as familiar with the western end, but I do like the comments that were made by Mr. Crawford about the western end, and I think we need to work on a little bit more about work a little bit more on that area to have a greater representation of the Latino community there. So maybe even though we do have it's Zone 4. That is a little bit higher. I think that needs to be reconfigured a little bit different. So that's my one area that I would like to look at, incorporating some of the comments that were made by some of the residents and community members from that area. But I do like, so far, Yucca is my favorite.
Can I just clarify that you like the three districts that go out in the East Valley that include the Indio, Coachella?
Yes.
Okay.
Hello. I really appreciate the top half of the Yucca map, page 57 of our agenda packet. I don't know where the big one is. And I like the bottom half of the Mesquite map. I like that the city of Indio is, some of it stays intact. I think there's still some like wiggle room in the middle of the valley to be played with. But those are my thoughts. I like the Yucca map top half, and I like the Mesquite bottom half.
So by top half and bottom half, I just want to be sure, like.
Sure, I should tell you. Zone. In the Yucca
map? You mean the I-10, or do you mean something different?
Zone 2, Zone 4, and Zone 1. Yes, Mesquite map, Zone 6, Zone 7, and 5, although I think there still could be some like lines to be moved around there. And then I have to agree with the comment from Mr. Crawford of Brown Cathedral City, having worked with St. Louis Parish and knowing that a lot of the community from Cathedral City go to the parish, and it's not, a lot of health conversations happen at the parish, and it not being included in Zone 4 could be a missed opportunity.
The only thing I would add, and it's sort of a question too, is that although we don't have to think about the 2020 census now, the reality is probably the zones in the east are going to shrink in size because their population is growing faster. In other words, there'll be more population in the east, which means their areas will get a little smaller. And have you taken that into consideration as you draw these lines? Since obviously in 2 years the lines are going to move, and it would be nice not to have dramatic changes unless we have to.
Yeah, so, and that's a good question. Where are the fastest growing areas of the Coachella Valley? And there are really two parts of the Coachella Valley that are growing much more quickly. And the first is actually Palm Desert. The area between Interstate 10 and South Palm Desert has exploded in population over the last 10 years. there was almost nobody counted kind of north of Fred Waring Drive in Palm Desert last time. Now the census is reporting 10, 20,000 people living there. The other area, as you mentioned, is on the eastern end of the valley, particularly as Indio and Coachella continue to kind of grow into each other out there. And so we have looked at that, taking that into account somewhat, particularly in the East Valley, we also took that into consideration because we don't know the demographics of that new growth out there, although we presume it's mostly Latino. The census hasn't been able to tell us that yet. And we've taken that into account with, the same thing is true of that growth in Palm Desert. We know that some of it is around that new campus, UCR campus there. We don't have a precise picture of the demographics of that yet because it's too new. But we have taken that into account, trying to at least slightly overpopulate some of the areas we know have grown less. For example, the city of Palm Springs we know is growing less quickly than some of the other areas, especially sort of the old core of Palm Springs. And same is true with some of the other older neighborhoods. The La Quinta Cove is growing more slowly. This part of Cathedral City is growing less slowly. Where we've taken that into account by trying to put growth areas and less growth areas into each of the zones.
So my comment then is, and I think we have to all keep reminding ourselves of this, is that each director, no matter which zone he or she lives in, represents the residents of the entire district. And that one of the reasons California Civil Rights Law Act, or whatever it's called, was created, and why we moved to zones, is so that people could elect people that looked and were in a community like them. Not necessarily vote the way those people want, although if they want to get reelected, then they're going to some extent. But I think that, in my opinion, a good director is going to do what he or she feels is best for the entire district. Because in the long run, that's what's going to make the district successful and to be able to serve all of the communities better. So I do think that we want to take into consideration who gets elected by the people electing them, but in terms of how funds are done, I think it's really up to the directors to do what they think is best for the entire district. That's my opinion.
I have a comment. Off of that comment, I would like to see a map that doesn't necessarily put a director in each zone. So I would like to see a map where it is okay for you to put Leticia and I, who are both from Indio, in the same zone.
Okay, and my comment is on that section on the Yucca map, where we have that little blue area that's coming down Eisenhower Drive. Is that area aligned with this Zone 7 because of the demographics in that area, or strictly for population-wise?
For voters.
So in Yucca,
that little dip. That's
looking to go.
Yeah. You put the color map up. I can't see. I mean, is that it?
Yeah. So the attempt in Yucca is to create, or see what it would be like to create three majority Latino areas. And so what we've tried to do is to accomplish that. And this is how you would do that in the East Valley.
So if you were have some continuity in terms of La Quinta staying intact, you couldn't accomplish what you just said by by having this maybe more straight across. So even though
what we've done is basically excluded the golf clubs.
Oh, okay.
So the part of La Quinta in the south that's not in Area 7 is mostly golf clubs. well, actually entirely golf links.
Okay.
And we've just gone around the boundary of the golf clubs there.
Question, is there a higher propensity of Hispanic voters in the La Quinta Cove compared to other parts of Zone 7?
Yes.
Yes.
And La Quinta Cove is actually where most of the Latino population in La Quinta is. Mm-hmm.
Can you turn the lights back up for a little bit? Are there any other comments? Okay, I'm going to open it up to more public comment if anybody has anything they want to say that hasn't spoken yet. Okay, and I'll ask the directors, is there anybody else that wants to add anything before we close?
My final comment is that I do hope that you look at creating three strong zones with the majority of Latino registered voters.
Okay, thank you very much, Esten, as always, for the superb work. We're going to move on to the next item, which is the report from the Desert Healthcare District CEO, Chris. No.
There you are.
Better.
All right. Well, the only thing I have this evening is just to inform the board that I'm working with the leadership at Desert Regional regarding the board touring the hospital. And those, just so it's public, that there is the ability for directors to be able to tour the hospital and coordinating, you know, through the hospital staff. So I know that some of the directors have already done that, so if there's any of the newer ones or even any that haven't done it for quite a while, those tours can be scheduled.
No, Andrea, never mind. I was going to say turn off that mic that's up there because it's causing an echo. Okay. Are you done now?
Yes.
Okay. All right, sorry about that. All right, and now I'll ask the Desert Regional Medical Center CEO for her report.
I'm just going to talk a lot. So, hi, I'm Michelle. I'm the Desert Regional CEO. Thank you, board members, for allowing me to provide you an update on what's been going on in the facility. I just got a few items to share with you. First is we had a very robust week, May 13th. It is kind of our big celebratory week. We celebrate Hospital Week at that time. We generally conclude Hospital Week by holding an event to honor our long-term employees. So I'd like to share with you that we honored 424 individuals that celebrated 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years of service, of which 849 of them are over 25 years. And next year we're going to actually have a very special award granted because we will have a nurse who will be working with the institution for 50 years.
Wow.
Yeah, she works in our labor and delivery, and she says she is not retiring until she gets to that 50th anniversary, and I think she'll be the first. Wow. In the history of the hospital.
How cool is that?
So a couple of other things. On May 15th, we did participate in the County of Riverside Tabletop Disaster Drill, and that's where we pressure test some of our internal systems to make sure that that we have in place the protocols that we need in place in order to be responsive to any kind of a disaster that might occur. And it's an opportunity, because you really want to train people when things aren't really happening, it's an opportunity to make sure that the staff and the leadership really understand how to work with the HICS disaster system and coordinate with the county. I want to share with you, because I like to share, or I share with the district when we have any kind of disruption of services. We did have a disruption of service that was took about approximately a week. It involved a water leak in our neuro ICU unit. So we did locate our patients to other suitable critical care areas while we hired a professional remediation company. And then after we fully remediate the water damage, then we come in and we do environmental testing to make sure that there's, that we pass air quality and environmental standards for operating the unit. And so we have reoccupied the unit, and it was approximately a week of time that, that we had some disruption in using alternative site locations. This one, kind of on the same vein, this morning we had representatives, nurses that are represented by the California Nurses Association, did what's called an informational picketing. It is a peaceful event where individuals that are represented from the union can kind of let the public know that they're in contract renegotiation and they have different areas that are important to them as they're renegotiating that agreement. So they were there, the informational picketing was there from 5:30 this morning to 8:30. It was very professionally managed by all. So I think that was good. What I do want to point out is that the news media got it wrong. So some of the news outlets said we actually were having a nursing strike. We were not having a nursing strike. Individuals who participate in informational picketing are off-duty nurses. So we had no increase in sick calls. People who were scheduled to work came to work and were at full tilt. So we are in contract renegotiations and we do expect to have a positive outcome, but it is a process that we're going through. We have several new physicians who are joining the facility. These are full-time physicians. We have a new spine surgeon joining the 1st of June. We have a new open heart surgeon that's joining September 1st. We have a new neuro movement disorder physician that's joining us October 1st. We have a triple boarded neurology physician who's an epileptologist, and I never can say that quite right. There's a child neurologist and an adult neurologist starting on June 8th. And then we have another epileptologist starting September 1st. And we have a neuropsychologist starting September 1st. And a pain management doctor starting August 1st. And you see, we've been pretty busy at looking at areas where we have shortages and some coverage needs, which are bringing in a full-time individual. All of these doctors are relocating to the area to establish full-time residence and full-time practice in the community. On new doctors to the environment, the next up is on June 12th, we will be celebrating our very first graduating classes of our residency program. We have 24 residents that are graduating, and we will be celebrating on that date. 9 of them are practicing internal medicine, 4 are in neurology, and then we have 11 individuals that are graduating from the emergency medicine program. In addition to that 24, we have an affiliation with UCR for Family Medicine, and they will have another 7 family practitioners that will be graduating in June, July time frame. From a construction standpoint, this week we have been getting ready to start our phase 2 of our emergency room remodel project. And for some of you that have heard me talk about this before, it involves our waiting rooms, our triage areas, our fast track area, and our registration area. So it is a complete reconfiguration of the front part of the emergency room, in large part to improve some patient privacy and some flow. We've been testing our workflows this week. The Department of Health has signed off on our workflows, and that we will actually take the unit to the new workflows June of next month. So the hospital will be fully open and fully operational during this construction period, which we expect to go till around November. We want to get it complete before we hit peak season in December, January, February timeline. So that is the objective. You're going to see these big, and actually we're debating them today because they're 12 feet tall. So there'll be these big exterior as we cordon off for safety certain areas. These will be these 12-foot posters. I'm just going to call them posters for lack of a better term, that will go up on the barricades that will direct people. So the ambulance entrance is not impacted. The pedestrian entrance is impacted. We have a side pedestrian entrance that will be the main entry point, and we have moved staff to that entry point to make sure that people get immediate triage and immediate attention to be able to report where they need for care. And That's kind of it for me. If you have any questions,
I'll... Board have any questions? Thank you very much. I'm going to give a report from the governing board meeting that Director Rogers and I attended on May 16th. We had a really good update annual report from the trauma service. As you probably know, the Desert Regional Medical Center has the only designated level 2 trauma center in the Coachella Valley, serving people in the whole Coachella Valley, East Riverside, and some San Bernardino, part of San Bernardino County. The volume has increased of the trauma service. It's gone from 224 in 2017 to 266 this last year. And I'm sorry, let's try that again. April of 17, there were 224. April of 19, there were 266 patients in that month. And last year, there were 2,200 trauma patients at Desert Regional Medical Center. They talked about some of the injury prevention and outreach programs they have, which I thought would be interesting. One is the Stop the Bleed program, which really enhances survivability for intentional mass casualty and active shooter events. So if there's a terrorist event or active shooter, they're training to really be able to respond quickly, and the first responders can respond quickly. They have a cooperative program with Mothers Against Drunk Driving. They have a pedestrian safety program, which they're working with several cities in the Coachella Valley, and including the California Highway Patrol. They have a Desert Hot Springs Public Safety Academy that they work with. They have a burn prevention education program. And with Living Desert, they have venomous snake bite lectures that they do. And I thought those were all very interesting. The board had an update from the Sacramento and DC tenant government affairs person. Talked a little bit about what the new governor and the supermajority state legislature is going to do, what they might do, and a little bit about what's not going to happen in Washington because of deadlock between Congress and the president. I'll just highlight a couple things from the CEO report that Michelle did not mention. The patient satisfaction scores, which the board has been tracking very closely, have significantly improved. April of 18, the score was 70.9. In April of 19, it was 73.1, and the goal is to be better than 71. So we're actually improving a lot there. And that's a concern that the board has had and the community has had. And another concern has been cleanliness around the hospital, some of which is real and some of it is just that it doesn't look clean, even though it's not dirty. But they have instituted some new things, including an environmental services dashboard, where they do black light rounds, where the staff goes in and cleans things, and then afterwards they go in with black light. Let me start over. They go in and they spray this stuff all over the place, where people with the staff should clean. Then they send the staff in to clean, and then afterwards they take the black light to see what areas were missed. And that's to educate the environmental services staff how not to miss things.
Can you tell them where we have to focus? Doorknobs,
mattresses, doorknobs. Things like that.
Yeah, well, doorknobs are what's not passing the black light check.
They're also tracking to make sure all rooms are cleaned daily with sign-off and reports. And then there's an infection prevention rounds twice weekly on every ward so that we can make sure that our infectious disease specialists and infectious disease staff are educating the providers and the nurses on how to do that. That's the end of my report, Carol.
Sure, just a few things.
It's fascinating to be on this board, hospital board, to see the different areas that the board looks at. You know, this is a private corporation, and two board members are allowed to sit on the board, and our role is to mainly make sure that the lease that we have in force is followed. But other than that, number one, listening to Heidi Anderson, the trauma services nurse, no wonder we have such a great trauma program. This woman is awesome. You want to be in a trauma, this is no nonsense nurse. Take charge, you know, just calm, cool as a cucumber. I was really amazed. Also, you know, it's fascinating to listen to the quality report. Every hospital in the country, you know, is guided by their Department of Public Health and also Medicare standards. And you go down the list, and this hospital is doing its best to make improvements in their daily services. We have a pressure injury prevention program that is a coordinated effort with the local SNFs, skilled nursing facilities, local hospitals, that everybody is trying to prevent pressure sores from patients before they come into the hospital. So that's really a great one. And just to, you know, the everyday operation of the hospital is just fascinating to follow. I was amazed at one point in the report where they talked about how a baby had to be delivered in the waiting room. So this is a real hospital.
And just a reminder that in June we will be having the next quarterly hospital inspection. And we will follow up on the items that were identified 3 months ago, and then we will inspect a different part of the hospital. So there'll be more reports on that at the next meeting. All right, Finance Director Matthews.
Yes, the Finance Administration Real Estate and Legal Committee met. The minutes are on pages 72 to 75. I'm not sure if any directors have any questions about them. Hearing none, I'll move on to the next item, the District Retirement Protection Plan. And for those of you in the audience who may not know, this is really for former, when the hospital was run by Tenet, by the district before Tenet. We still manage that retirement plan, and it's doing quite well. And those folks should be, those employees who are gearing up for retirement will be in good hands from those investments. Any questions on that? I suspect none. There's two resolutions that we need to put forth. Our investment policy resolution for 2019 and 2020. It basically, we don't invest in tobacco and booze.
Soft drinks.
Restaurants. And restaurants. So I would move approval of the new investment policy resolution.
Second.
Second.
Do we need a
roll call vote?
Roll call vote on this? I don't know.
Do we need a roll call
vote?
No.
No. Low dollar amount.
Okay.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? None. Okay. The next item is our legal counsel rate increase from $200 to $225 per hour, which is the first increase in quite as long as I can remember. And the committee reviewed that and compared it to other council, whether it be cities, districts, or whatever, and we're feeling pretty good. So the committee recommends approval of that $25 per hour rate increase, and I would move such.
Is there a second?
Second.
Any further discussion? I think we need a roll call vote on money.
Yes. I have a discussion really quickly. On page 127 on the budget.
We're not there yet.
And legal fees, we talk about potential litigation. So I'm just wondering, as we ask for this pay increase, my question was, what services do we receive when we're paying for potential litigation? Is just that another way of saying, like, a retainer agreement?
You're into the budget now for potential litigation.
Yeah, so on page 127, what are you looking at?
Line item 6560 under expenses. It just says how much legal costs. It says legal fees for operational coverage, potential litigation, and policy review.
Yeah, it's just a general budget for legal fee expenses. Don't anticipate any kind of, you know.
Is that the language you should be using?
Well, I think it's a good description just in case there is any that were to come about. I mean, it's just a general budget for legal expenses to cover any of those areas.
If they thought there was something coming up that we might have some potential liability, then they would add that to the budget.
Okay, thank you.
So right now it just covers legal fees. Does that answer your question?
Yes, that's
a question. Okay. Yeah, it's meetings, it's whether you as a, when you're filling out your forms, have a question and you want to call the lawyer and go, is this a problem? So a director can call legal counsel directly for advice on legal matters.
Because they're on the team.
So keep the calls short.
Yeah, keep them short.
Answers shorter.
I like to send an email and get one back because it's, you know, cheaper. But if you're really in trouble, you need
to. You don't know how fast he types.
He types good.
All right, thank you.
All right, so there's a motion. Was there a second?
Yeah, second.
Roll call. I need a roll call.
Director Shore.
Yes.
Director Borja.
Yes.
Director Perezkio.
Yes.
Director Rogers.
Yes.
Director Matthews.
Yes.
Vice President DeVara.
Yes.
And President Zimbo.
Yes.
And the last item I'm going to throw to Chris.
Salary range.
The salary ranges and the budget.
Okay.
The salary ranges we approved, so I can take that one. My computer shut off. But the budget I'm going to toss to you. In there is a list of... where's the ranges? On page 114 are the board-approved salary ranges for various positions and the current salary in there. And the committee reviewed that and recommended approval of that. Is there any questions or discussion about that? And do you have any comments?
Maybe at the same time, include the job descriptions all in one vote.
You have the program officer, outreach director, and all the other. So each position has a job description.
Some of which
has
been edited.
updated and edited to current responsibilities as people come and go or take on additional responsibility. So those are in there as known changes.
So are there any, you want to move?
I'll move approval of.
Is there a second?
The salary ranges and the job description.
Second?
Second.
Any discussion? Comments? No?
Any roll call.
Okay,
Director
roll call.
Shore?
Yes.
Director Borja?
Yes.
Director Perezkio?
Yes.
Director Rogers?
Yes.
Director Matthews?
Yes.
Vice President DeVara?
Yes.
And President Zimbo?
Yes.
So we have the 2020 annual budget, which was reviewed and recommended for approval. But it's pretty detailed. And Chris, do you want to highlight anything special in there and draw that to the attention of any board members? But we reviewed it. It's consistent with where we are today with appropriate increases and anticipated. So go ahead.
All right, just a couple of quick highlights. Las Palmas Medical Plaza, we typically net about $200,000 from the rent, less the expenses of the medical facility. One of the things to note is that we increased the professional fees to $840,000 for the year, anticipating some significant work surrounding decisions that the board will be making regarding the future planning and programs, services, the hospital, et cetera. So just wanted to highlight that potential expense there.
I have a question. It has to do with the investment income. And how you project next year is going to be positive, but it's not always positive. Could you explain that so that those of us that didn't go to Harvard Medical School for MBAs can understand it?
Well, I anticipate the investment income to be positive going forward. There was a few years back, the board had the investment policy was to purchase higher coupon rate on the bonds, which earned a higher interest rate, but we also essentially got a loss on the sale of those bonds. We bought the bonds higher for the investment benefit, but then also when we sold, we had to sell par. So it was kind of a break even for a period of time as we transitioned
out of that process and actually purchasing bonds at essentially 2% now instead of 4%. So that, as those prior bonds have been maturing and expiring, those losses have been recognized. And so now, going forward, we should be in a little bit more of a total net positive investment income.
Okay.
Just to clarify, the only investment the district, and I'm not talking about the retirement plan, which is separate, the only debt investment the district can make is in government bonds. Correct?
Correct.
Okay. So it is like rather
very secure.
Depending on Tesla.
Very secure, low
return. Yeah. And so however the market goes, so goes our investments of government funds. So we've got a motion to approve the budget. Any further? Oh, you have a question, Leticia? Go ahead. Fire away.
What page are you on?
Okay, I'm on page 125, and the discussion items, the bullet points, 1, 2, 3, 4. Bullet point where there's the discussion of the $300,000 related to the expansion area. And I same comments I made last time. I'm not sure if it's appropriate to bring it up now or at a later date.
We will be going through the foundation budget when we get to the foundation. And this was just kind of an overall recap of the entire budget, but the $300,000 does lie in the foundation. So it would probably be a good time to discuss that.
Since the district gives it to the foundation, isn't it originate here? Or
no, the $300,000 that we're talking about in the foundation is coming from non-taxpayer dollars. So
I think
with our current investments that we have in the foundation and some.
I think the question is that, and I know that our attorney, Jeffrey Scott, sent out a memo to board members about that $300,000, the resolution that was done. So one is when will we talk about that, the future of that? And two, are there opportunities to designate other revenue that is non-taxpayer or that is not generated from property tax in the West Valley to add to, if we wanted to add to that amount, add to the $300,000, put more money into the foundation to use for the east side? When would be appropriate time for that discussion?
Thank you.
I would say that's an item that you could add to the agenda for next month or whenever the board wishes to do so.
So approving the budget today does not limit us from talking about that and making decisions in the future?
Correct. Because what would end up happening then is that you would ultimately, if there was more revenue coming into the foundation, whatever the resources are, in turn it would go out as an expense. So the overall net effect to the net income or the bottom line would essentially be zero.
Okay. Is there any more discussion on?
I have two questions. One of them is that many organizations are evaluated by the public as to their percentage of overhead versus income. And I would wonder if, you know, are we 10% overhead, 20% overhead? What is our ratio there? And then the other one is when I'm looking at the grant expenditures from the district, are those funds transferred to the foundation? Those funds?
Some are.
The $3.5 million that we're talking in budget goes out to nonprofit organizations. So there is the possibility that some monies could go to the foundation. But everything that's granted to external foundations come from the district directly.
Okay.
So they don't get transferred to the foundation.
Thank you. And then this $3.5 million, is that a stable number? I seem to remember that the 1 year it was $4 million. And has that changed? And what's the formula?
Well, we've typically done $3.5 million in the budget. There was $500,000 that was done out of the foundation, so I think that's the $4 million that maybe is being referenced like collectively between the two organizations. But there also has been a good history that even with the $3.5 million in budget, that the directors can also grant above that, which we have in previous years. So the $3.5 million is just a budget number and you know, can be adjusted as the board sees fit through the year.
Any further discussion? We should take these separately, the district first and then the foundation.
Correct.
Yeah. So have we made the motion on the district budget?
I believe you did. Oh, yeah. Second.
Okay. Motion and a second. You want to take the vote?
Sure. Do you want to go call?
Did you make the second?
No, no.
Okay, second. Okay. Somebody made a second.
Second.
Okay, Director Short.
Yes.
Director Borja.
Yes.
Director Perezio.
Yes.
Director Rogers.
Yes.
Director Matthews.
Yes.
Vice President Guevara.
Yes.
And President Zinn.
Yes. Yeah, the foundation budget doesn't come till the foundation.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Good work, committee. All right, now we're going to move to the program committee, which has been very busy, and I'll hand the microphone to Director Rogers.
Thank you. The program committee was reconstituted in May, and you'll see the minutes in our meeting minutes in our packet. The reason why the program committee was formed again was for an opportunity for board members to delve into grant proposals in depth, in more depth than we have time here in regular meetings, and also to recruit people from the community to sit on our advisory committee, which you will see also on the agenda. So I'm thinking that the best way to start is to announce the next scheduled meeting, which is June 11th. Do we have a time and place for that yet?
It will be at noon, and we UCR Palm Desert is tentative at this time.
Great. So we have that. And then in the packet, pages 146 to 150 are grant proposals under development, which means those are ones in process. Did anybody have any questions or comments about that? Okay, let's move on to consideration to approve the grant policy, which we looked at and proposed changes for. Did staff want to address that?
So the policy that was presented took into effect the efforts that have been worked on by staff over the last year with developing like a scoring process for applications. It's also implemented an upgrade to our grant software. There's been extensive work done by staff and working through that, developing and training, and feel that we have that pretty well under control now. This is really the first round of significant batch of the grant applications that are going to be presented to you today. Also incorporates some of the 2019 parameters that would be required for the directors and staff to follow those guidelines exactly in the AB 2019 for transparency purposes.
Any questions about that?
I move the policy be adopted.
I'll second.
Second.
I have a discussion item on the policy. If not now, for the future. Section 4, the district will not support the following. I believe we should include something around discrimination. There, as we move forward on housing and funding large amounts of money into any kind of homeless initiative, The population that gets discriminated quite often is the transgender community. So just making very clear that we will not be funding anyone who discriminates on any kind of basis would be my recommendation. If not now, for the future.
I think that it would be okay to insert that now. Will staff accept that?
So that was to include any organizations that
on page 155, funding restrictions.
Did I understand that correctly? To exclude any organizations that are discriminating in any fashion, is that the way?
I will move to accept that with the changes and the funding restrictions. Who's seconded?
Betty seconded. Second. Okay, and do we need a roll call vote on this?
No.
No? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Great.
Next on the action program is page 157, which is a new grant process review that has come as part of our new computerized system.
Correct, yeah. And it incorporates what we were talking about in the policy that includes the grant scoring process. It's more of it's a better way to actually score the grant applications. It kind of takes away any kind of bias, limits that, and allows a much better process and for transparency's sake in the awarding of any grants. And so it just takes us through the flow chart so that anybody can see how the process of grants flow through the district.
Okay, I recommend approval.
I'll second. Is there any discussion on the grant process?
I just have one question. What is the typical timeline that it would take from stage one to actually tonight approving a grant?
I can't hear you.
About a month between program committee and board meeting dates. We try and schedule so it can be continuously flowing. So
from stage one?
Stage one is the letter of intent, and then staff starts to review. We have the audited financials if they're not a mini grant, check press reviews, gives us less than one sign off on, and then we'll generate stage two, which is the actual application. And that's when the scoring comes in and the budget review.
Well, but the process from stage one to final board approval is not a month, because it depends on how long it takes the organization to turn in the requested materials and to work with staff to make the proposal.
It averages about a month.
It's very good.
We work pretty fast.
Okay. It's not how fast you work, it's how fast the organizations respond to your request for financials and things like that.
They have to be included in part of the stage one or stage two before they move on in the process.
Okay.
So as part of stage one, we ask for preliminary documents, and then once we move on to the full application, we ask for additional documents that are all part of our new grants management software. That's why we're able to the turnaround is much, much faster because of that. It's all automated, and it gets data from the initial LOI and transferred over to the application.
Any other comments or questions before we take a vote? Okay, all in favor of the grant process, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Great. Ronald McDonald House.
Yes. Idea is to have staff give us an overview of the grant application, and if there are questions, if there are people here that represent the different charities that are here that would answer your questions.
Okay, just to preface, we did have seven grant applications that came through, and the three directors approved moving approval to the board for all of them. So, I think it says on the staff reports, which we know we're talking at Ronald House, that the program committee members solicit the action for recommendations to forward the board for consideration. Committee recommendation that grant award $200,000 be approved. Project description is listed in there. We do have a representative from our long house up here if you have any questions for Karen, the executive director. Other board members have any questions?
Did you want to add anything before questions?
No, I would just move approval.
Okay, move approval. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, any questions from the board? I just want to make a comment. I think it's true. This is a good example of something that's going to help people, residents of the Coachella Valley, no matter where they live. We're not going to say, oh, you can only serve people with these funds who live west of Cook or east of Cook. So we need to take that in consideration that this is a district-wide program. Okay, that's my only comment. Is there any more discussion? If not, we'll have a roll call.
Director Shore?
Yes.
Director Borja?
Yes.
Director Celestio?
Yes.
Director Rogers?
Yes.
Director Matthews?
Yes.
Vice President DeMara?
Yes.
President Zinn?
Yes.
Next, we have a grant application from Martha's Village and Kitchen for $200,896 for homeless housing with wraparound services. Donna, would you like to have a
discussion? Again, this was moved approval by the three committee members to move to the board for consideration. Marcus is asking for a grant to alleviate the barriers for housing and help, averaging about $17.20 per day of nightly to house homeless residents. This is a particular homeless resident that are coming from the west. Linda Morant is here, Executive Director, CEO, President, excuse me, if anybody has any questions for her.
Move approval.
Second.
Second. Is there any questions for our guests? Any comments? Then we'll take a roll call.
Director Shore?
Yes.
Director Borja?
Yes.
Director Perez-Gill?
Yes.
Director Rogers?
Yes.
Director Matthews?
Yes.
Vice President
DeMara.
Yes.
President
Zimmo. Yes. Great. Next we have grant 989, Pegasus Writing Academy, for $109,534.
Pegasus Writing Academy is asking for this dollars to fund unduplicated 115. We put children, those going to deaf children as well, to receive equine therapy, hippotherapy. That means doctor's orders, doctor's referrals. And again, this is for clients that are in the original boundaries of the district. And again, the program committee directors selected full recommendation for support. And Rhonda Montgomery, Executive Director, and Chase Burke, COO from Pegasus, is here if you have any questions.
I move for approval.
Your second?
Second.
I have a question. Why is it only restricted for use of people who live west of Cook?
Because we're using taxpayers' funds.
Okay. I actually asked that question during the program committee meeting. And the response from the applicant was that they've actually identified funding to cover the residents from the eastern end. So I think that was actually a very good example of organizations that know about other funding sources and being able to access other funding sources.
And I guess I would add that I hope in the future we don't have to start dividing, especially, I mean, if we're talking about huge grants, but this is $109,000, that we don't have to start making them pay attention to where somebody lives rather than the need that they have.
And there's two sides. Like Lenny says, at least they are leveraging other dollars, not just paying 100% on district funds to fund their program, which is one of the scoring requirements as well. What is the high percentage of leveraging their funds on other sources?
Great. Any other comments? Questions? Roll call.
Okay.
new board members that we see who do.
Explain what, for the new board members, maybe explain what the program is.
I know what the
program is. Do all the board members know what the purpose of the brush has?
I know what it is. I've heard about it before.
Okay. It's a wonderful program, and if you watch the video, there's no question of the benefit it brings to the people it helps.
I'm a new board member, and I'm fully aware of the program and the clinical value it has. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Roll call.
Director Shore.
Yes.
Director Borja.
Yes.
Director Gillespie.
Yes.
Director Rogers.
Yes.
Director Matthews.
Yes.
Vice President Guevara.
Yes.
And President Zippo.
Yes.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda is consideration to approve grant 994, One Future Coachella Valley, a two-year project for $700,000.
This is an actual continuation of an initiative that was started about 4 years ago with the district funding the beginning of it to advance behavioral health care workforce, specifically in the schools, starting in middle school, high school, continuing on post-secondary, and this is a two-year proposal. It also incorporates $100,000 in matching scholarships for those students that have selected a career pathway in behavior health, which is sorely lacking. And one of the things I just did want to mention that this is a true collective impact model that does not work or happen overnight. It does take years to formulate this to get the outcomes desired. Sheila Thornton, President and CEO, is here, as well as Ernie Rios, if anybody has any questions for them. Again, the program committee directors moved approval unanimously to move this to the board.
I recommend approval.
Is there a second?
A second.
I have a question. Will these funds come from the behavioral health care fund that we have, the $2 million we've set aside?
No.
I'm sorry, I can't understand you.
It's from the district, but it's not from the behavioral health initiative that's in the foundation.
So it comes from the $3.5 million that is in the budget for grants coming out of the district funds.
Well, so does the $2 million that
they give. How much you asked specifically about
the district. Okay. So it's not being taken out of the $2
million. Correct.
Okay, just asking.
I have a question. You said it's 4 year?
2 years.
But you said the program started 4 years ago. Do we have any numbers? Do you have any numbers of graduates? How much aid you've given? Any of that?
So thank you very much. So it was actually 2 years. It was a two-year grant that we started this on, and the request came as a result of a discussion between the California Endowment Regional Access Project and the Desert Healthcare District, recognizing that we've been focusing on health careers broadly across the years. So 2,200 scholarships have been awarded across the last 10 years. About 47% of those have gone to healthcare scholars, but we had not specifically focused on behavioral health professions and knew that there was significant issues on the upstream side around just career exposure to it, scholarship awards to it, students navigating the system, and even employers defining what it was that they needed in terms of pipeline development. So we've been at it now for almost 3 years with the help of the last grant. And we started with the strategy around career academy. So in the, I won't go too long on this, but the concept was you've got pretty significant infrastructure here. There are 6,500 students in career academies across the desert. 1,500 are in health pathways. And what we decided we would do was embed behavioral health strand into those health pathways. So in this grant, 90 educators and business partners came together, developed a tactical plan around what they would do to support those students. They embedded behavioral health pathways into two of the seven academies. So that means roughly 300 students are affected by that pipeline. We awarded $300,000 in scholarships. $60,000 of that was to students who were in their master's, their MFT program. We embedded what's called mindfully resilient, so a behavioral health theme within all three districts, three high schools, and that's going to be scaled in this next grant, and that's all about getting at the stigma associated with behavioral health career pathways for our students, because many of them, first, don't have exposure, second, don't have access to behavioral health services, as you all know, and so we saw that as, and this alignment team saw that as a really critical component of the work. Does that help?
Yes, very helpful. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Roll call.
Director Shore.
Yes.
Director Borja.
Yes.
Director Brescale.
Yes.
Director Rogers.
Yes.
Director Matthews.
Yes.
Director Demara.
Yes.
And President Zindel.
Yes.
And the last grant that we are looking at is Grant 1000, Voices for Children.
You missed 10.
You missed the
one.
One Future Coachella Valley. Sorry about that. Grant 995, One Future Coachella Valley Summer Internships with Desert Healthcare District and Fine Food Bank. Donna?
This is a small grant covering a period of 6 months to fund two Health Career Connection interns, student interns. One is going to be at the Desert Healthcare District, the other one is going to be at Fine Food Bank. And,
great.
I recommend approval.
Is there a second?
A second.
Is there any discussion? Roll call.
Director Shore.
Yes.
Director Borja.
Yes.
Director Brescale.
Yes.
Director Rogers.
Yes.
Director Matthews.
Yes.
Vice President Lara.
Yes.
And President Zindel.
Yes.
Now, last grant, 1,000 Voices for Children, 24,000.
Again, this grant was approved by the program committee members for full recommendation. Voices for Children, Riverside County, is the CASA program, for appointing special advocates. And the grant for $24,000 would add in the cost for recruiting, training, and supervising a CASA volunteer for a year that would provide special advocacy to children in Coachella Valley, 12 children. We do have Jessica Munoz is here, who's the executive director. If you have any questions for her.
I move for approval.
I second.
Any questions or discussion? Hearing none, we'll take a roll call.
Director Shore.
Yes.
Director Borja.
Yes.
Director Brescale.
Yes.
Director Rogers.
Yes.
Director Matthews.
Yes.
Vice President
Lara.
Yes.
And President Zindel.
Yes.
Before we move on from the grants, I'd like the representatives from the grantees, if you would please stand, just so that you could be recognized and appreciated for the work that you do.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
Can I also say something?
Sure.
I'm really glad that we had this group of organizations be our first go around, because they were all were strong organizations that have strong track records, and it was easy to say yes to them because they were all fabulous. But now you set the bar high, so. But thank you very much.
And I guess I'd like to add a thank you to the staff, especially Donna, who really is the one that shepherds this, and Chris and the other staff, Alejandro, and also Carol, to you as the chair of the program committee for getting this through and everything.
Great. Our last action item is volunteer community member appointments. As you know, we changed our bylaws to add 5 new member appointments to the program committee, and I was asked by some of the representatives that wanted the appointment, asked, you know, what their duties would be, and I said, ask good questions, that's what we like, and to get various viewpoints in terms of the funding sources and process. So at this time, on page 245 of your packet, you'll see the names of the applicants and those that are here, how would you like to proceed?
Did you ask them to stand up?
Stand up.
They're good, so why don't you introduce them?
Yeah. Stand up and introduce yourselves. Luciana? Luciana Crespo.
Great.
Jack. Thomas, the
member?
Nope.
He was here, then he left.
Oh, I thought I saw him. I know that Thomas Smith isn't here. Nicholas Berman? Okay, great. Anyway, under your consideration is appointment of four members. We will, the program committee will interview the fifth person and maybe a sixth, we don't know yet, at our next program committee meeting and bring you a recommendation for appointment of a fifth person. Make a motion that we appoint the four members that are proposed.
Do I hear a second?
I second.
Okay. Is there any more discussion? Great. And I think this can be, doesn't need to be a roll call. So all in favor of accepting these four committee members, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Congratulations.
Thank you.
Now we're going to turn to the Board Staff Communications and Policy Ad Hoc Committee Director, Delora.
Okay, the three items, starting with number one, is just a quick informational item that we, the board did meet last week talk about communications and how we can work better together, communication between the board members and also between board members and staff. It was a very good workshop. I think we all got a lot out of it, and now we have to just walk the walk, I guess. So, and talk the talk, more important. Okay, the next item is consideration to approve resolution 1908. This is an item that we've talked about in the past. It's an action item, and this is a policy from 5 to 6 meetings per month, starting July 1st. Is there?
Make a motion.
I will make the motion to approve.
Is there a second?
Second.
Is there any discussion? Roll call.
Director Shore?
Yes.
Director Borja?
Yes.
Director Perezio?
Yes.
Director Rogers?
Yes.
Director Matthews?
Yes.
Vice President Delora?
Yes.
And President Zendo?
Yes. Now there is a ordinance to talk about.
Okay, the last item is consideration to approve ordinance 19-9 to increase the stipend compensation by 5% starting January 1st, 2020. This is an item we talked about in the past, and we are recommending approval.
The packet says 19-1, but the agenda says 19-9, which is
since it's an ordinance, it should be numbered 19-01.
19-01, okay. If there's a motion to approve, is there a second?
A second.
Is there any discussion? And this will not take effect until January, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Roll call.
Director Shore?
Yes.
Director Borja?
Yes.
Director Perezio?
Yes.
Director Rogers?
Yes.
Director Matthews?
Yes.
Vice President Delora?
Yes.
And President?
Yes. Old business, marketing and communication plan, Mr. Dean.
I am happy to say that our website is live. We launched on the 14th. And I want to thank the directors for the feedback received. And we are continuing to work. We have some stuff to do on the back end to make sure that all the documents that are required on our site. It's gone well so far. Also, earlier this month, we deployed our first newsletter. We had about 430 delivered. And our next deployment will be in July. And from that point, it becomes a quarterly newsletter. Any questions?
Any questions or comments? Great, thank you. And then in your packet is a update from CBAG on the CB Link Quarter 1 2019 status report. If there are any questions, maybe Chris can answer them. Are there any questions or comments? Okay, move on to new business. 2020 census. Who's going to talk about that?
Thank you.
While she's pulling that up, I'm just going to do a quick introduction. As we know, the Census 2020 is fast approaching, and the data collected impacts decisions from the redrawing of Valdiesburg redistricting, like we heard earlier in the presentation, as well as funding allocation for billions of federal dollars at the state, county, and local level, and how extremely important it is to get a complete count for the Coachella Valley. So we're lucky enough to have Karthik Ramakrishnan here to share what's happening at the local level and kind of just give you a high level, some information, and just stress the importance of a complete count for the Coachella Valley and see how the district and foundation could maybe play a role in regional efforts. He is appointed the director of the Inland Empire Complete Count, as well as a professor at UC Riverside and the founding director of the Center for Social Innovation at UC Riverside. So I'll let him take it over, and the presentation is in your packet.
Thank you. Thank you, Megan, and hi, everyone. It's been a fairly long meeting, so I'm not going to dwell into too many of the details and leave it up in the Q&A for any follow-up questions. As Megan said, we have an Inland Empire Complete Count Committee. Typically, counties themselves are responsible. Complete Count Committees can occur at various jurisdictions. There's a State Complete Count Committee. Typically, counties are the next level, and then you have city and other jurisdictions that can also form Complete Count Committees. I'll say a little bit about what Complete Count Committees do. First, I'll just talk about the scope of the challenge that we have. You saw a presentation earlier in which one of the major ways in which an accurate count matters is to be able to draw district boundaries that honor the principle of one person, one vote. So if you don't have an accurate count, you're not able to do that nearly as accurately. But of course, a census complete count matters for representation more generally at a state level in terms of apportionment, in terms of the number of congressional seats that we have. Some estimates show that we might lose a congressional seat in California if the undercount is severe enough, and especially if you talk about hard-to-count populations like immigrant populations in this state, that could really affect not only our county and our region here, but our state more broadly. An accurate count also is essential for good business intelligence. So this is something that we're hoping that is a matter of engagement not only for public entities such as the district, as well as foundations, but also corporations. The kind of business intelligence that we have is only as good as the decennial census. Any kind of market intelligence that we gain is based on what you can think of as a gold standard. It is done every 10 years. Anything that is done after that, such as the American Community Survey, is a sample. You can think of that as a copy based on the gold standard. So we need to make sure that this is as accurate as possible. In terms of trying to figure out what the challenge of the undercount could be, we can look at the 2010 effort. So if you look at that, in the last census, nearly one out of four households in Riverside and San Bernardino counties did not mail back their census questionnaire, requiring more costly and difficult in-person follow-up. This time around, the first wave is going to be done electronically, so there are going to be reminder postcards, but the first wave is going to be online. Brings up new issues in terms of digital divide. The census has planned its budget, presuming that the vast majority of Americans will be filling it out online. So any gap that we have will raise the cost of doing the census count in terms of in-person follow-up. Last time around, about 40,000 people lived in census tracts that did not receive a census questionnaire by mail at all because they did not have traditional addresses, had large numbers of vacant housing, or were otherwise rural or sparsely populated. And this is something that could be an issue this time around as well in terms of the first wave of postcards that go out. Broadband access, this is going to be a significant issue this time around. Across both counties, about 15% of households had either no internet subscriptions or dial-up only access. There are different ways that we can measure hard to count by census tract. Here I believe this is using the state hard to count tool. And you see that there are various census tracts in the Coachella Valley that have very high proportions of
hard-to-count populations. This is zooming in a bit deeper. You can go to the census online complete count tool to get more information. How is the Inland Empire organizing to achieve a complete count? One is, you may have heard of the ACBO. This is the Administrative Community-Based Organization application to the state. So the state has various regions, and the Inland Empire is one region. Both Riverside and San Bernardino County are Region 7. And the Community Foundation serving Riverside and San Bernardino put in that application. One strong reason for doing so is that the Community Foundation is also the one hosting the fund for most private foundation money coming into our region. So many of us believe that, that this would be a fairly efficient way to have one fiscal sponsor, if you will, that was holding the private dollars as well as the $2.4 million state funding opportunity for the for community-based organizations to be able to allocate that efficiently across both the public and private side. What that gets us is actually not all of the all of the effort that needs to be done, and that's one of the ways that the Desert Healthcare District, as well as Foundation, can play a role. Right now, when we look at the effort of the ACBO, that is enough funding to cover census tracts that are 25% or more hard to count. This is door-to-door knocking to make sure that people understand the importance of census, the integrity of the census, and how their information is protected, and the ways that communities stand to benefit or lose, depending on whether or not people participate. So there's a significant role that still a significant gap that still exists in terms of financing to make sure that this door-to-door effort is as complete as possible. Beyond that, so in addition to what the ACBO does, each county has funding from the state, about $1.5 million each, to use various government agencies to get the message out. Although even in those instances, what we have found here and elsewhere is that nonprofit organizations are the most trusted messengers, especially for populations that are skeptical of government. And this is not just the federal government. This includes local government as well. If someone thinks that someone is going to be concerned about code violations in a house, or problems of overcrowding and the like, nonprofit organizations are the most trusted messengers to assure people that the kind of information being shared about the number of persons in the household and other information about the dwelling is not going to be used against them. In addition to that, we have the Complete Count Committee. What the Complete Count Committee does is make sure that information is being shared across sectors between the public sector, the nonprofit sector, the business sector, as well as researchers. What we're trying to do is to avoid duplication of efforts, but also make sure that there's no major gaps in regions and also for particular hard-to-count populations within each region. We're also trying to make sure that resources are allocated efficiently and equitably across the two-county area. And finally, to also create a legacy, to make sure that our region emerges stronger after Census 2020 than before. So thankfully, we have resources this time, unlike in 2010. So we have resources both from the state and from private philanthropy. And our hope is to get community organizations expert in their communities, right? To be able to work with data not only from the state and the federal, from the Federal Census Bureau and the State Complete Count effort, but also the kind of locally produced knowledge that will be so important for what happens after Census 2020. So one of the significant hopes is for us to be stronger heading into Census 2030, but also to have the kind of grounded policy understanding so that community organizations are as expert as government experts, as well as researchers like myself, in terms of the needs of our communities. So what are we doing? Beyond the Center for Social Innovation, beyond being tasked with pulling the Census Complete Count Committee across both counties together, we're creating standardized data collection practices across stakeholders. We're working with both counties as well as with the Esri Corporation to build community asset maps, and we'll be rolling that out in the next few weeks. We're creating a data hub for outreach coordination and logistics, working in collaboration with Inland Empowerment which has built a significant amount of experience in terms of working with individual voter files and the kind of community outreach that they've done. And now we're expanding that beyond voters, obviously, right, to also account for all residents, regardless of their voter registration status, but also regardless of their citizenship status. And then finally, we're trying to get better collectively, working with the public sector, nonprofit, and businesses to be more savvy and innovative in terms of our media outreach. I'm not going to go too much into how we got here. You'll see that in your board packet. I'm happy to talk about that more. One of the big things that's important is earned media coverage. And so far, we've gotten decent earned media coverage. In addition to these front page headlines, the Desert Sun is starting to cover census, and we're hoping to see a lot more earned media coverage, because that's going to be important. In addition to earned media coverage, there's also paid as well as earned social media coverage. That's going to be important. There are other census state funding opportunities for media outreach, including ethnic media outreach. And I believe the winning bid on that will be revealed in the next couple of weeks. And so as far as I understand it, there's a statewide application, but there are subcontractors for different regions and also for different communities, including communities of color and language communities. The way that our Census Complete Count Committee is structured, this is based on design sessions that we had with government agencies and officials, both counties as well as entities like CVAG and WRCOG and different local governments that were part of these design efforts. What we did was be innovative. Instead of just looking at what LA County is doing or other counties are doing, we started from scratch to figure out how do we want to build a complete count committee. We could have done it solely by subregions, right? So to have committees based, say, on Coachella Valley, on High Desert, on San Bernardino Metro, etc. We could have also done it solely by hard-to-count populations, so say LGBT populations, the disabled, homeless, immigrants, etc. We could have also done it by institution type, so all the city managers getting together and talking about census, all of the school superintendents getting together to talk about census. That was something that people rejected from the beginning. They said, we get together for all sorts of other reasons, and the concern was that census would fall to the bottom of the list, given all the other business that that these institutions have. So what we did was went with a hybrid approach. The approach that got the most support was to do it functionally. So for example, with media marketing, to get people from government that are specialists in that, to get people from the private sector that are specialists in that, to get people from the nonprofit sector that are specialists in that, and to work across sectors. That idea generated a lot of excitement, and we've already met, we've had the first round of meetings of these committees, and personally it's been very enriching for me and very heartening. Often we see the usual suspects that show up time and again when they're called to serve. And what's amazing here is we're identifying so much new talent from the public sector, the nonprofit, as well as the business sector. So we have education, recruitment, and training. Naleo is taking part of the lead on that to make sure that people have the kinds of materials so that they can engage in peer education, not just in terms of person to person, but also peers embedded within organizations. Media marketing, I talked about that already. Interagency coordination. We want to make sure that city governments and special districts are coordinated with the work of other government agencies within our two-county region. We have a committee for stakeholder expansion and advocacy, and this is especially important for making sure that we're engaging with the for-profit sector, as well as with faith-based communities. The work there is ongoing, and we'd love to get your engagement to expand the kind of engagement we have so far. And then finally, we have data research and evaluation to make sure that the kind of outreach that we're doing is efficacious. Finally, we have field outreach that is split by regions as well as by hard-to-count communities, and that's what you'll see in your board packet. So we have various regions. One thing I should note, San Bernardino Metro is San Bernardino Metro as well as the mountain areas. nearby. We have the High Desert, Morongo Basin, Riverside Metro, Riverside Central, Riverside Southwest, Riverside Eastern. This is all Riverside County, by the way. So Riverside Eastern includes the Coachella Valley as well as the eastern regions beyond. And then finally, tribal governments. And we're working with entities like TASN and others to see what's the best way to engage tribal governments. Tribal governments can form their own complete count committees, and we're in the early process of trying to figure out if they want to do that, and or have a tribal governments subcommittee within the regions committee. Similarly, we have a similar kind of structure of subcommittees for the field outreach team, or the committee that is charged with hard-to-count populations. So you have limited English proficient, young mobile populations, LGBT. By the way, in Riverside County, the census tract that had the lowest response rate from the initial wave was the census tract that covers UC Riverside. Right, so you have a lot of students, and they themselves and their parents are confused in terms of where they should be placing the individual. So the census, it's important to make sure that everyone is counted once and in one place, right? So the young mobile population is important to make sure that we do the sufficient outreach there. LGBT, homeless, children, undocumented, African American, Latinx, Asian American, Pacific Islander, disabled, transitioning age youth, and American Indian and Alaskan Native. You might say, American Indian, are we covering them twice? Most Native Americans do not live in reservations, in tribal governments, and so it's important to try to reach out to the urbanized American Indian population. Finally, in terms of subregions, this is the way that the work of the ACBO is split up, and this is the way that we've carved out the work of the Complete Count Committee as well. You can either go to Census IE, that is the work of the administrative community-based organization sponsored by the Community Foundation serving Riverside and San Marino counties, or you can go to IE Counts, which is the Complete Count Committee. We cross-list everything between the two websites so that if someone goes through one door thinking they really need to go to the other site, you'll find similar content and you'll find links, cross-references to each other. So this is the Eastern Riverside County area. This is a deeper look at the places, census-designated places and communities that are covered there. And Alianza is the regional coordinator for the regional ACBO work in Eastern Riverside County. Happy to talk about next steps. Right now, we are in the early stages of doing pilot work, so I would encourage you to get in touch with Sylvia Paz from Alianza, who's in charge of the regional coordination work for the ACBO. When you go to our website for IE Counts, you will see several members of the IE Complete Count Committee that come from Coachella Valley. We also have a nomination form. Please nominate yourself or other colleagues. We'll check in with them first before you nominate them. And especially when it comes to, as I said before, the for-profit sector as well as faith-based communities, we need to get a lot more engagement than we do right now when it comes to the service of these various committees. So I'll leave it at that and happy to answer questions. All right.
Does the board have any questions?
Oh, I have a question.
Very thorough.
Okay, so thank you very much for making this presentation. I have a question about Alianza taking the lead. I know that they're very strong on the Eastern Coachella Valley. Are they partnering up with somebody else on the Western end, or are they being responsible for the whole Coachella Valley?
Yeah, so this is true for all of the regional coordinators. They're responsible for the entire swath. So while they may have particular strength even in certain populations, we see this with other regional coordinators, so this is important capacity building for all of our nonprofit sectors. Now, they are the regional coordinators that they in turn will work with other community organizations that have those trusted relationships, either with particular populations or in certain parts of the region. So just because someone is a regional coordinator does not by no means means that they have the entire thing handled. The success of a census complete count will depend on all of us pitching in. So some of them will be funded opportunities, some of them will not be funded opportunities. But the key is to be able to have regional coordinators that work with the Community Foundation, as well as with our center at UCR, as well as with Inland Empowerment, to make sure that we're not dropping any balls and making sure that areas are not left untouched. So there is going to be tracking, right, in terms of when field workers go out there. So it's not just employees of Alianza that are going to be doing the field work. They're going to be paid employees of throughout the region that are going to be doing that door-to-door outreach.
Great. Thank you very much. Very good. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. Coachella Valley Regional Table 284, what is that? Yeah,
that's just kind of a short summary flyer regarding Alianza that was being referenced.
Okay. Do we have any legal comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have no report this evening.
Okay. And are there any director comments, reports, informational items, and staff for staff direction and guidance?
Thank you. I just, well, number one, I'm sure that there are others that will report on our trip to Fresno with Rise and great information that was given there, but I would like to report on a request that I received from Christy Halstich, Council Member, City of Palm Springs. She writes, I'm requesting that the Desert Healthcare District and staff collaborate with the City of Palm Springs to review the feasibility of partnering to develop a shelter crisis beds facility, especially for this summer. So at this time, there's some conversation about that?
I believe we're going to be talking about that during the foundation meeting. We have Greg Rodriguez here, and if we want to have any discussion and direct the staff to do anything in that area, we can. I also want to report on a meeting that I had with Desert Sun today and a meeting with Supervisor Perez that's scheduled for tomorrow. So we can do that later, and you can add something later. Anything else? Great. I think that is the end of that agenda. So we're going to adjourn this, take a 5-minute break, and then we'll do the foundation meeting. And it's not a short foundation meeting.